Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 225, Buddhism in the West.
Teaching is a great privilege, actually. It's a wonderful profession. It is by far the most fun of any profession that I've ever tried my hand at. And actually, in Buddhism, teaching is a tremendous privilege and one of the greatest things you can do, because by teaching, if you know anything yourself, or even if you're like me and know nothing yourself, but you know some sources that do know something, In the process of transmitting that, you can be present at the moment of the birth of a new understanding in the mind of the people you talk to. And that sort of change in the human brain, that little subtle sort of software place, or in the human heart, of opening a little bit or coming to a new understanding, is the most precious thing in the universe, the Buddhists believe. And when that thing is carried to its extreme point, it brings a being to a new form of life, actually, called enlightenment, where their even whole biology changes, in fact. So the gift of teaching is a real tremendous privilege. And therefore, the thoughts that I have launched into boldly and foolishly in these last three lectures, and I'll be even more bold and foolish perhaps in this last one, have been very much thanks to you, because it is something that happens in the interaction of the minds. It is not just that one person sits up there and like spouts off and then the others are like some kind of blank slate. There's a common questing, a common mental process, set of mental processes that are going on, and a kind of magic that takes place when the subject is something of deep vital concern to all of us. The sort of destiny of humanity, if you will, our fate on this planet, you know, which is not at all secure, I think. I think all of us, I mean, even though it's California, We do know that. And, New York, it's even more obvious. Which is why New York is an invigorating place, of course. So now, to re-summarize, we began in the lectures by trying to discern through looking at the different aspects of Buddhism. We tried to discern many levels of what Buddhism itself actually is. And the main point that we made in that phase of that first lecture was that Buddhism is not really just what we mean in modern times by a religion, and it was not, although it has become that in various places now. So it is not a religion, but it is not just a religion, but it is many other things. And we went through a long list of the different types of things that it is, that it has been. And one of the main of which we emphasized was that it was a social revolution. The Buddhist movement was a revolution in its time in ancient India, and then everywhere in every country that it went, it was a kind of social revolution, and at least also an intellectual revolution, other kinds of revolution, but social as well. And then we dwelt at some length on Buddhism as an educational liberation movement, a movement that in a way is different from what we mean in modern times by religion, where we understand, you know, the modern definitions of religion by sociologists of religion or people tend to emphasize what they call the pattern-maintaining role of religion. That religion is a sort of set of beliefs or symbols or a system of behaviors and institutions that holds people's behavior and minds and sense of meaning and purpose in life and death in a certain fixed pattern. And the old meaning of the Sanskrit word dharma was that. Dharma comes from the root dhar, which means to hold. And so dharma in India could mean religion. It could also mean duty, law, custom even. Anything that holds something in a pattern. When Buddha came, he gave a redefinition of Dharma. He said, the Dharma I have discovered doesn't hold you into some fixed pattern. It holds you apart from suffering. My whole purpose, the Buddha said after he was enlightened, is to help you find a way free of suffering, a way to freedom and happiness, not by adopting a belief that won't unfortunately get you to freedom and happiness, not by following a certain ritual that won't get you to freedom and happiness, not by some sort of mechanical practice will not get you to freedom and happiness. The only thing that will get you to freedom and happiness, he said, was your acknowledgement of your actual state of suffering. You're coming to have sensitivity to your own state of suffering, rather than pretending to yourself and others that you are just perfectly fine. It's sort of I'm fine type of I'm okay sort of thing. But actually realizing that you yourself, due to the delusory ideas that human beings are saddled with by tradition and culture and so forth, are living as sort of as if you had, compared to how you could be living if your sensitivity was fully open, are living like someone with some sort of vice clamp in their heart or something. Some sort of squeezing thing there in the center, like someone did open heart surgery and left a clamp in there or something like that. And so, and that was Buddha's observation. And that vice clamp, of course, is the deluded idea of the absoluteness, the absolute centrality and the absoluteness of the self. That the self is some fixed, eternal, unchanging thing that is the real you, and that is absolutely different from everything else in the universe. And therefore, that it is a situation where you are struggling against the universe, all other beings, which they're all absolute other things. And between that, in that struggle, of course, you inevitably lose. And you, because you die, no matter how powerful you are, you die. No matter how wealthy you are, you lose it all. No matter how strong you are, you grow weak and sick. Even if you're a god, from the Buddhist point of view, you become a god and control universes. There's bigger gods down the block in the multiverse who come over and step on you in your universe. So from the Buddhist point of view, that sense of egocentric self-absolutization is the core delusion or misknowledge or ignorance that is the source of all the suffering. And when one can find that, acknowledge that, one recognizes and becomes sensitive to oneself, one's suffering. And then, having done that, not just to wallow in it, but to understand its cause. What has caused it? How did this delusion form? How can this delusion be unraveled? And the behaviors that spring from this delusion, how can they be diminished? And how can the kind of behaviors that would spring from freedom of this delusion be encouraged? And then there is a process like that. And then through that process you can achieve, known as the Eightfold Path, you can achieve freedom and happiness. That was the Buddha's thing. So therefore, he was forced to be an educator. The poor guy, you know. Because, you know, he had to go out and try to raise funds for his school, you know. Which was even more difficult then than now, or probably about the same. And nobody wants to give people funds for schools. They think people in schools are gold brickers, do-nothings, wasting their mind. You know, Socrates was given the hemlock milkshake for, like, getting the young Athenian machos to think a little bit, because it might have made them vulnerable to the Spartans, you know, the city fathers thought. And so it's hard to get people to support schools. Everyone, of course, their whole life is formed by whatever they learned in any school, and the school of the family even before that. But still, once they're grown up, they know what's important, and they don't think schools are it. And so we made a lot about that, because it's not usually understood that way, Buddhism. Buddhism defines itself. Buddha himself said, what my Eightfold Path, what my system, what I brought you to his contemporaries and posterity, is three spiritual or three higher educations, the higher education of morality, the higher education of psychology or meditation, how to control your inner mind and emotions, and the higher education of wisdom or the intellect, how to understand your reality. And unfortunately, the Buddha said, every single human being can become free and attain enlightenment. And not only that, but I'm determined that all of them will, he said. But unfortunately, no one can give that enlightenment to them. There's no transmission of that enlightenment from a guru. That's a false notion. There is no gimmick. There's no bioelectric feedback machine. There is no pill that you can swallow that gives enlightenment. Enlightenment can only come from your own understanding. And the only way your own understanding can be helped is by instruction, reasoning, evidence, experience, experiment, and then you can develop understanding. So therefore, you can see how I argued in that first lecture that Buddhism is not just a religion, in fact, not primarily a religion, but really an education system that was founded. And then finally, I gave my favorite definition of Buddhism, sort of, which I actually elaborated with you, the idea of Buddhism as an evolutionary sport, meaning that a person who comes to understand reality the way the Buddha did and sees their own life as an infinite play of different lives, having come without beginning through all different, you know, this sort of chain of being, having been a god, having been in a hell, having been all kinds of animals, having been all kinds of humans, having been male and female and all kinds of other varieties, mixtures in between, and then going on in the future infinitely, similarly. So when one begins to get a feel of life as this vast, infinite sort of river of different forms of existence, then the goal becomes like, well, I have to be here. I have to be here with all of these people. We all have to be here together forever. But it's always going to be in constantly changing forms. And if we don't put a lot of effort into seeing to it that those forms are optimal, are magnificent, are joyful for all of us, then they could get really bad. We could go into a dog-eat-dog sort of situation like the planet Earth in much of its history. And so therefore, we will play at evolving to a condition where everything we do and feel and think will be helpful and benevolent and beneficial and produce joy in others, and nothing we do or feel or think or say will produce misery and suffering in others. And then once we get that idea and we see it as a continuum where death is only a shift, a transformation, just like falling asleep is only a break between 2 days, so death is only a break between 2 lives. When we get like that, then we've reached the form of where we see Buddhism as evolutionary sport. So then we looked at the history of Buddhism, moving toward the end of that lecture and then going to the second lecture, history of Buddhism as a spread of individuals wishing to adopt that kind of purpose of life, of having life as an evolutionary sport, having sort of seen the reality of life as an endless continuum. And the Buddha, to keep his own vow, which as a bodhisattva on his way to being a Buddha, which was that he should not become a Buddha and fully liberated until all other beings were liberated, which put him in a sort of problem, right? Because we feel we are not liberated. But somehow he must have felt 2,500 years ago that we were liberated, or he broke his vow. Now, how did he do that? Well, he saw through the superficial reality of time. The moments in the future when each of us will come to our full unfoldment, when we will come into our own full glory as fully enlightened and fully loving and fully joyful beings, those moments in time must have been evident to the Buddha at his moment of enlightenment, or he was a no good goal breaker at that moment. He should have said, no way, I don't want to get enlightened, because all those San Franciscans are going to be like, you know, waiting in line and bugged and suffering this misery of sitting in this lecture with this like mad professor from New York. So therefore, the moments beyond that where they come to their enlightenment is I see that as real as this moment. In other words, a being whose awareness is present in every moment of time, past and future, which is how Buddhism, of course, is defined, Triadvajña, as it is called, the knower of three times. So, but then, although he knows our future moments, we still don't know it, and we're still caught in what we think is a concretized flow of time, tick, 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 tock, tock. And so then a Buddha's goal as a compassionate being is to somehow emanate to us through time, to be with us and help us at these turns, to extend institutions through time, to extend traditions through time. And of course, in the Tibetan view, in the Mahayana Buddhist view, even extend emanations through time. And Buddha might be in the breeze in a voice that says, no, no, don't turn left, turn right. No, no, don't beat up that person, be nice to them. Don't be afraid of this one, talk to them. It might be a voice in the breeze like that. It better be, actually, again, or he broke his vow. So anyway, the Buddha then talked about the concept of, you know, the Buddha was prophesied at birth to be one of two things. He would either be a world-conquering emperor, and, you know, much better than Napoleon or somebody like that, I mean, really doing it. Because in the Indian legend, the world-conquering emperors really had the equipment. When they were born, a giant gold spaceship, like a Close Encounter of the Third Kind sort of thing, would come and park over their palace. And then when they were crowned, all the kings of the earth would come and submit to them without a single shot being fired. And anybody who was thinking of not showing up or competing, this golden giant wheel about the size of a city would go and sit over their palace until they decided to book a ticket and get going over to the jamboree, you know. So they really did rule the world, you know. And those emperors in the Indian thing are not like Big Brother tyrants, horrible things, because the Indian social history was not as authoritarian as ours in those days, quite. And their concept of this kind of universal emperor was a very benevolent one who could actually help people and could, like, order the military to quit and to put the money into education and health and welfare and so forth, and they genuinely did. And they had tremendous economic surplus and a very wealthy planet at the time. And so that would have been a great thing to be, a world-conquering emperor in such an era. And yet, to become a Buddha was more important. It was considered a much higher achievement, and its influence over the planet was considered much more far-reaching, because to become a Buddha, they believed, was to be able to reach into all generations of the future of the planet and to conquer the planet from the human heart out, not from some sort of social structure in. That is to say, to conquer the planet via the Dharma, by letting the hearts of the beings on the planet open to their own greatness, really, their own joyfulness, by means of knowing about the Dharma. So then the Buddha's challenge was to do this campaign of Dharma throughout the world. And of that, in order to do that, the great institution that he left and invented, actually, was the institution of monasticism, where people could drop out of their normal social preoccupations, serving the collective, serving the family, you know, fighting the wars, doing all the different jobs, and instead they could unfold themselves evolutionarily just by shaving their head, wearing a robe, giving up their property, and giving up usually unsatisfying sex. And so this monastic thing became highly popular, and believe it or not, especially women liked it. Which doesn't say much about the men, I guess, in a way, even in those days. And the reason, of course, they liked it in those days and in any such place where women were, you know, in the extended family agricultural society, where they were sort of chattel of the parent, the father at first, and then chattel of the husband, and then chattel of the son, and then with a little mother-in-law bossing in between. And it wasn't really a very jolly life. And so they found monasticism extremely popular, and it spread wildly throughout Asia and was constantly being pruned back by the kings. And the guys were constantly closing down the nunneries so they could have back their dishwashers and their servants. And anyway, this engine of monasticism went throughout all of the countries of the East and the West, actually went into Iran and was known and had influenced probably Christian monasticism, which only arose 800 years later. And of course it created Chinese Buddhist monasticism, which was Buddhist, about 800 years later. And opening up that vow for the individual to escape from the collective, to escape from the power of the state and the high priest in all of those societies. In a nonviolent way. And we unpacked this concept of monasticism, which in our Protestant-influenced society we don't normally think of as an activist or world-changing institution, but we unpacked the concept of it as actually the one historical counter-institution, counter to the major institution in our recorded history, which has been the universal military institution, the Army of Universal Conquest. That has been the other major institution that launched itself at about that time. The Trojan War, you know, the Mahabharata, the city-states of Eurasia at that time unleashed this concept of conquering the world that we've still been struggling with still ever since. And because they got the technology and the food surplus and the social organization level to be able to contemplate not just battling with the neighboring city-state, but actually conquering it and absorbing it into a larger structure. So these two, the monasticism and militarism, have been going neck and neck for 2,500 years, and the monasticism was started by the Buddha. So we looked at that. And then we looked at the progress of that movement in five sort of peaks, using the theory of a Japanese scholar, a friend of mine, which were sort of five renaissances, first four of which are well known to most of you, the time of the Buddha himself in India, which was also known as the Axial Age in Eurasia, and which is the same time as the time of Socrates, the time of Confucius in China, the time of Zoroaster in Iran, and many other teachers in India and everywhere in the world. It was very much a turning point of time. And all of the major Eurasian civilizational streams today are still looking to that time as the sort of paradigm solutions to the problems of life, like in the liberal arts, you know, in a university today, you begin philosophy really with the pre-Socratics and Socrates. And in China, you look back, well, before the communists, you look back to Confucius. And in India, you look back to the Buddha and the Upanishads and the people of that same time. So that was the first one, about 500 before the Common Era. Around zero of the Common Era, you have the emergence of social Buddhism, known as the universal vehicle Mahayana, which spreads without any violence throughout Asia, throughout India, throughout Central Asia, over to China, into Iran, through the Kushan Empire, and has a major impact on those civilizations. Then about 600 years later, you have the rise of tantrism in Buddhism, where women become much more important and powerful in Indian religion, and both in Hinduism and Buddhism. And then you have a similar renaissance, although less developed than in India, in China during the Tang Dynasty, around 700-800 of the Common Era. And then, again, although there's that sort of big movement in India and China, reaching a quite high level of civilization toward the end of the first millennium, gets cut off by the first Western invasion, the Mongol invasion of China and the Muslim invasion of India, and they get sort of put back, those countries, into a more militaristic mode because of this external conquest. But in around 1400, from around 1200 to 1400 of the Common Era, you have a big renaissance in the two islands, or the two isolated places, Japan off of China and Tibet up in the Himalayas between India and China, where all the people run away from the Muslims and the Mongols and other various oppressors, and they develop quite a high time. And we get the forms of Buddhism that have had tremendous impact upon us to nowadays, the Japanese and the Tibetan ones. Now, this Japanese scholar concluded this lecture the years ago, which I unpacked more in that second lecture, with a statement that there should be a fifth great moment in the history of this movement of Buddhism, but it can't happen in Asia, because Asian Buddhism is more or less moribund, he said. And he said, where could it happen? Only here in America. At which point, everyone in that lecture woke up. This was years ago, and they decided that things might be serious after all. And then he discussed how, we try to discuss how that might happen. And in understanding that, we then looked at how a revival of Buddhism might happen here. And what we decided, or I put forth a thesis, again, thanks to you, I came up with that formula just thinking it through with you, that actually Buddhism could never... The reason that Buddhism might be able to create some sort of a renaissance here in America is that Buddhism, as it has come here, has reverted to being an educational movement or an evolutionary sport, a kind of something that is not routinized in any way here. People might turn to because they despaired of all the routine institutions and religions and sort of habitual professions and meaningless cycle of production and money-making and money-losing and family-making and family-losing and health and sickness and so forth, and they're fed up with the whole thing in the context of a materialistic, meaningless bunch of jumping atoms which would all come to naught anyway. And so they would decide that, hey, you know, I'm sort of half dead as it is, and I hardly exist, and so why not use this sort of situation? I can think, though, and I can play with my CD-ROMs and the internet. Why not use this life form to sort of see if there's anything higher? Anybody, and then look around, see different people say there's this and that mode of getting something higher, of having some sort of broader thing, of developing an understanding beyond the limitations of this body and mind, body and brain, let's say, you know, develop a software that can be portable to other forms of hardware in the future. And so, in other words, people approaching it not in some sort of routinized way, oh, here's a new thing to believe in, a new little niche to put myself in, but people are looking at it as basically a catalyst in their own decision evolutionarily to come to terms with their own situation of life and death, and to decide that the human life form is not there to plant rice seedlings or to diddle some machine button and twitch that game board thing in the electronic space age battlefield with aliens or whatever, pursue a big bank account, have big numbers behind one's name, but rather, you know, develop a big thing where some other person after you die will be writing checks on your checkbook anyway. But instead, you decide that this mind, this incredible sensitivity, this incredible ability to think all kinds of things from different perspectives may be able to move me, if not the whole world, into some completely new kind of realm. You know, there might be some, like, higher order of bliss, some higher order of happiness. After all, we live in the country where we're supposed to go out and pursue happiness, right? I mean, that's what he told us, right? Once you have your life and liberty, then you better pursue happiness. How many of us actually do pursue happiness? Not much. I don't think so. We sort of think maybe we are, but actually anytime a little happiness comes around, we guiltily look around and then hide, thinking that if we get happy, it might be addictive, it might be bad for my health, someone will rob me or beat me up because I'll let my guard down, and I can't therefore trust it. So nobody really is looking for happiness because they think it's dangerous, right? But anyway, someone might come to that idea and decide that maybe these ancient methods from this tradition, which is not the wisdom of the East, some broad thing coming from some nation, it was never at home in any nation that it was. It was always only a countercultural movement in India. The Indians and the Chinese, they were beating their wives, torturing people, behaving badly themselves, just like everyone else. They were actually a little better than us because they were less poor, and they wouldn't concede, and they were more individualistic, actually, and they wouldn't concede to those kind of really dumb kings who would order you to do this and that as easily as we do. But we did in those days, but they were sort of similar insubordinate as we are nowadays, and sensitive, and they developed great traditions, So anyway, someone might decide that and get into it in this non-routinized way, in this way of evolutionary sport, we decided. But then, if it became a thing where many people said, well, I want to be a Buddhist, and now let's start a church, a Buddhist church, and let's have a Buddhist this and a Buddhist that, then that would only provoke antagonism on the part of all the people who want to be Christians or Jews or fundamentalists or Muslims or whatever, and would just become another membership drive, and it would become a new routine, and it would probably not work. I elaborated that thesis. And certainly people who I consider very visionary in the Buddhist movement, such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh or others, they don't try to just enroll everybody as a Vietnamese or a Tibetan Buddhist. They, in fact, discourage it. They say, if you want to be enlightened, if you want to be wiser, if you want to be more kind and more sensitive and fine, but you don't have to just go nominally, go pound people over the head and say, now I'm a Buddhist. That's just a new way to be egotistical. And better to be nice at whatever you are and use any methodology, of course. Use the education available, but don't just go and start card carrying around. It's too late. He tells these other religions, somewhat falling on deaf ears in many quarters, but he tells them, it's too late, guys, to keep this thing up that you're going to convert the world to your particular ideology or belief system or structure. You're going to put everybody in your cage. We don't want to put them in our cage. You shouldn't try to put them in your cage. It's too late in history for that. Religion was there and founded by all of the founders of the religions, not to put people in cages, but to help people develop their love and kindness and tenderness and civilizedness. It wasn't put there to give them something else to beat each other over the head with. They had plenty of things to do that, and they didn't need Jesus Christ or Muhammad or Buddha to give them new ones. So the people who interpret them that way have done their own founders a tremendous disservice, not only the people who interpret Buddhism that way, but any of the world religions. At least, and I agree with that point. So therefore, the thesis of that lecture was that Buddhism will be able only to make a renaissance or to help assist people's real need for something new with a renaissance by not being Buddhism, whatever experience it has gained, by offering the education in meditation and the psychology and the way the deep way the heart and mind functions, by offering the wisdom and the inner science and the experimental methods of coming to verifiable knowledge of reality that supposed Western science is supposedly looking for, although only in the external way through machines and through measurements and things, whereas Buddhism gets into the quality of the observer directly. And as some Buddhist masters I know are saying, they're very happy with Heisenberg and the uncertainty principle and the acknowledgement on the part of quantum physics that the observer is part of the observation, because then that means that then the science of how to structure the observer and how to handle the observer becomes important. And this one Lama used to say, we've been waiting for you guys for centuries to stop thinking that you're going to find happiness in some sort of a petri dish. So, but Buddhism can offer that without being Buddhism. No one has to enroll and be Buddhist. That's not at all necessary. In fact, Buddha didn't have a word for Buddhist. He didn't say, oh, let's be Buddhist. There, he said he was a Buddha occasionally. Sometimes if someone had a wrong idea of what a Buddha was, he would say, oh, there is no Buddha, or wouldn't say anything. But often he would say he was a Buddha, but he didn't say he was a Buddhist. He didn't say people should be Buddhist. He said people should understand the nature of the self should transcend the egocentric, deluded self habit, should transcend the possessiveness habit, and hatred, and greed, and envy, and pride, and the 22 other minor mental afflictions such as hypocrisy, pretension, and many things. A whole bunch of mental mechanisms, unpleasant mental mechanisms, which we all recognize a lot. So that's how we came up to today. Then I lost my notes last lecture, some of you may know, so I didn't do a couple of things I wanted to do preparatory to today, which was I didn't really launch into the task of getting all the Buddhists very upset by running through a kind of survey of the different teachings and schools and institutions and movements according to the principles we've worked on together through the three lectures. You know, the principles of evolutionary movement or educational movement, social revolution, the principles of, and therefore socially activist, the principles engaged, as some few Buddhists will say nowadays, the principles of Buddhism being not a niche religion, the principles of Buddhism flourishing and helping the human being to flourish in our difficult times by not being Buddhism, by being the energy of it without the form of it.
Aloha, greetings, and salutations, dear podcast wallows. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded during Professor Thurman's 1996 trip to the California Institute of Integral Studies. To learn more about this four-part Visiting Scholars series, please look in the podcast description. Links will be provided to the California Institute of Integral Studies website, where extended versions of these talks can be found. Special thanks to CIIS for making these talks available through the Creative Commons licensing. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special VIP invites to special events like the annual benefit concert at Carnegie Hall, curated by Tibet House co-founder and vice president Philip Glass, please visit the Tibet House US website at tibethouse.us. You can help make a difference with your monthly membership donations. Help Tibet House present and preserve Tibetan culture in New York City at Tibet House US and in the Catskill Mountains at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by our dear friend Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about the music and work of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode, which concludes with some poetry read by Gary Gock. Thanks for tuning in.
Now we come to the future, and we come to the question of cosmology and the question of what the future may hold. And we find, to our surprise, that Buddhism does not, as a whole, does not have a single view of the future. Buddhism is like, in its whole historical phenomenon, all the different movements, all the different things that it is, and literatures that it has generated and so forth, is a huge, vast, diverse thing. There's no one thing that Buddhism thinks about many things. There are certain things like don't kill people and stuff, that's univocal. But like what's going to happen in the future, there are different things. For example, the ground cosmology in Buddhism is the Kali Yuga cosmology, meaning the Dark Age cosmology, because that was the live cosmology in the Brahminical conservative society in the Buddha's time, because they were conservative Brahmins. And conservatives at all times and places have always think that the world is going to the dogs. You know, they always do. They think that their own kids are like never as good as they were. They think that the new generation is always like corrupting something and missing out on the good old days. They have a vision of some good old days someplace, and they hang on to as much things as they can and are as uptight about the future as they can be because they expect it to be worse. So therefore, they have a cosmology that, you know, the world is running down, it's all going to go into a state of despair and disaster. And the Buddha didn't dislodge that in the wide population he was teaching in, because it was useful in the sense that it got people whose real problem was their internal vice clamp that was squeezing their heart every day, all day, unbeknownst to themselves, who were cheerfully running around planting flowers and things. Meanwhile, they had this vice clamp in there. And so that he wanted them to attend to that problem. So for them to be not distracted in, let's go change the world, until they've dealt with their own internal vice clamp and they had know what the world is, was important for him. So he said, yeah, the world is going to the dogs, don't bother with it. Save yourself, find your own internal happiness. And then once you're happy, you might be able to do something, at least in some area, about the going to the dogs. And it isn't completely hopeless in Buddhism, because about, you know, it gets really bad, though. We get down to where people have a lifespan of about 10 years. We're all about 2 feet tall, like gophers. We live in little holes in the ground, which we have stocked up with Uzis and machine guns and poison pellets and all kinds of things and nuclear ray guns, and we jump up every 15 years and kill each other off, and the local people in the nearby groundhog holes, and then go back in the holes. It really gets bad. The Buddhist view of Kali Yuga, the human life's condition becomes extremely much worse than it is now. But then it starts to turn around. Somehow people get sick of it. They start being more kind. They stop taking lives. Therefore, their own lives become longer. They grow up, and then they actually come to a kind of golden age about 100,000 years from now. And then the next Buddha, whose name is the Buddha Maitreya, comes down to Earth. He's present in a certain heaven nearby Earth and sends down things now, but, you know, doesn't always overcome the problems. But so he's very active in Buddhist cosmology and history, the Buddha Maitreya. But he doesn't really come in full glory and in full sort of mission until about 100,000 years from now. And then there's a golden age. And everybody who maintains, Maitreya means love and loving one. And everyone who maintains faith and love in the middle of all the disasters and is kind to others and so forth is said to be reborn in the time of Maitreya and to achieve enlightenment under the teaching of Maitreya. And by the way, it's very easy. Maitreya makes it, if you can make it to Maitreya's time, he just hands out some little, he's born a Brahmin, not a warrior, a priest. And he has a giant jeweled sacrificial post that he inherits from his father. And when he inherits that, he cancels being a Brahmin. He takes the post and he smashes it. And then he dishes out a piece to everybody who comes to see him. And then everybody who gets one of the jewels from that post becomes enlightened. You know, they meditate for a little while, then they become enlightened. So that's a pretty good one. Then there's a second cosmology that doesn't emphasize the Maitreya thing, which is the Dark Age theory that you find in Japan and in other places. And there they say, although it's a dark age on this planet, they emphasize the multi-planetary nature of Buddhism, the multi-dimensional nature, that by dying and being reborn, you can go to a completely different planet in a completely different cycle, evolutionary cycle, just like that, either better or worse. And so the goal in that kind of, the cosmology there emphasizes the imminence of the Pure Lands, what are called the Pure Lands, or the Buddha Verses, as I call them, which are these incredible lands that go way beyond the infrastructure of any Dharma center that we ever can imagine. You're just reborn there and you have this kind of magnificent body. You never get hung up and horny like out of celibacy because you have male and female elements inside your own body and you just sort of like sit there with a grin on your face all the time. And you don't have to eat food because, you know, the air just comes in and nourishes you. And you don't have to go around looking for a guru because there's like a Buddha about 38 kilometers tall who sits there and radiates out different things and gives you different teachings and messages and so forth. And you know, you can stay there as long as you want. You don't die any prematurely and so forth. And there's no traffic. And even the ducks go by on the jeweled ponds And as they go by, they go quack. And then in the quack, it says that egocentrism is suffering and the cause of suffering and the freedom from suffering. And so you get teachings from the quacks of the ducks. And so in those things, and then the tantric practitioners are like that. They try to get off-world right away into these mandala realms and zones of different deities, the pure land of the Dakinis. That's a really great one. I think it's kind of like California. It's these Dakinis really give you some teachings up there. They really do. And although if you come in with an arrogant macho attitude, you're in the big trouble, they say. There are a lot of stories about them. And so anyway, that's the second type of cosmology. Now, a third type of cosmology, which is the one that is mainly only in the Tibetan Buddhist countries exists, is the cosmology of the Kala Chakra Tantra, as I call it, the Time Machine Tantra. The Tantra which gives the most full symbolic treatment, I think, of the theme that I mentioned at the beginning of tonight about how a Buddha cannot attain Buddhahood 2,500 years earlier or any time that is still caught in a materialistic, concretized flow of history, leaving out other beings who are not enlightened. So therefore, a Buddha, to attaining Buddhahood, doesn't mean you as a unit separated from the rest of time or from the rest of beings just sort of have a liberation and you're all gassed out. That's impossible. A Buddha, because you would break your bond of connectedness and your vow of love and compassion and interconnectedness and non-differentiation with other beings. So therefore, a Buddha, to attain Buddhahood, has to extend that compassion of theirs through time, because other beings cannot instantly be blasted into Buddhahood immediately. They take their time to evolve to Buddhahood, because they have to evolve to it, because they have to learn, they have to be able to enjoy it. And to enjoy it, they have to develop the instrument, the body, the brain, and they have to develop that by generosity and morality and tolerance and so forth. And they have to do that through their own growth and interaction with other people. And so therefore, a Buddha extends through time as a machine. A Buddha's compassion is present. They become an infinite being, not only in space but in time, at the time of enlightenment, and they reach out into the future in the form of compassionate emanations, and they're present to all beings in the future. And this is symbolically conveyed by that Kala Chakra, you know, which has 24 arms and 4 faces. It doesn't have as many as some of the other deities, but and then all of the elements of its body are units of time reaching into the future. And it's a marvelous symbolic sort of mandala. And there's 722 deities who work with him and her, it's a male, female, and they reach all everywhere into the future to help beings. And the key about that one, that relates to the country of Shambhala, you know, Shangri-La, the magic country in the future, which is not Tibet. Don't worry, it is not Tibet. It is not Mongolia. It's north of Tibet and Mongolia, and it's a magic country hidden under a force field in the Tibetan belief. And that country is a planetary country. And this tantra then teaches a kind of cosmology that within a couple of hundred years from now, the Mr. Bad, you know, the big brother, dictator, and at that time there is kind of a world dictator, they say, and also there's a lot of dispute about when it is. It might have been a few hundred years ago. It might be hundreds of years in the future, but it's near now. It could be tomorrow. I always used to argue, especially in the 60s. I always expected it tomorrow. And I argue with lamas who tell me it's only 327 years from now. I still argue with them, and they get a big kick out of it. But anyway, it's sometime soon, the Shambhala prophecy. And at that time, then this world becomes more manifestly a Buddhaverse. And people are ripened with amazing rapidity to new levels and layers of consciousness. And there is a kind of vast planetary awakening. And it's the same type of thing like you have in... You know, one great thing I noticed that recently I read in an environmental conference we had with the Eastern Orthodox patriarchs in Greece and Turkey last summer, I had occasion to reread the Book of Revelation. And there's a wonderful thing in the Book of Revelation that is like the Shambhala prophecy in the sense that after all the difficulties in Armageddon and everything, and getting to the New Jerusalem, there is no temple in the New Jerusalem. There is no need to rebuild the temple in the New Jerusalem. The New Jerusalem, the temple is in every facet of life. Everything is holy and sacred, and the divine is all in all, and therefore love and wisdom and so forth is all in all. And it's a fruitional, millennial thing, you see, where, you know, well, you're in the temple washing dishes, you're in the temple, whatever they do, in the coffee shops of the New Jerusalem. I don't know what they're going to do there, but I hope they have decaf. So Shambhala is like that. It's a worldly realm, which is similar to our realm, and yet it's a sort of perfection of our realm. It's when our world becomes really like a spaceship Earth, And this spaceship Earth is not just flitting around, you know, meaninglessly, but this spaceship Earth becomes then a theater more manifestly perfected and facilitating the individual being's own evolutionary unfoldment.
Those are the different cosmologies within Buddhist expectation. And I think the one that suits America probably is the Shambhala Kala Chakra one. I feel it fits with the, because it fits so neatly with the New Jerusalem. Even America, as you know, was always thought of as the promised land, and there was a whole big thing in some of the early intentional communities in America. And, you know, the 18th century really thought that. You know, people did think that 17th century when they came, they got out of all the grubby cellars and tenements of Europe and came over and saw a nice bunch of land to steal and little deers hopping around to slaughter. They loved it. They thought it was great. And so now, how do we go there? Now, coming back to the process of what we do now then, how do we who have found something useful in Buddhism, something of interest in it, who are finding it helping us, you know, some aspect of the philosophy or what, how do we try to effect a change and to extend this Buddhism that can dare not being Buddhism and yet can serve people without having to impose itself on them as Buddhism? How can we align with this? Well, there are a whole number of examples. I made a whole list, and which are some of them beginning to happen. And the one that I'm going to unpack in most detail is the school level, because since Buddhism basically is an educational movement, then a fully Buddhistized society, one that was beyond any niche denomination of Buddhism as a separated religion, it would be a society where the national purpose of everyone in that society would be to lifelong educate themselves. And that education would not be just to learn how to, like, drive this and that machine and learn how to do this and that, but that education would be to open up their own sensibility, to deepen their empathy with a wider group of people, to know more deeply the nature of reality, to become more brave in helping others and so forth, and more skillful at it. And that's what that would be. And so we would have a lifelong framework where we could just live for educating. Can you imagine such a society? Take the entire budget of the Pentagon. Take all the presidios in the whole country and make them campuses, and then give everyone total support and scholarship to go and study all the time, and as long as they wanted. Many people probably would not want to. Many people would want to go out and drive a truck and do things. That's the thing. You don't have to worry. You know, they'll want to go do things. But even the ones who are driving the truck, then you could have the internet in there, like giving them a lecture on Plato, you know, or Buddha or Freud or whatever you want, whatever the person wants, and while they're driving, you know. And it should be a totally educational situation. So how can we make an educationalist society? That's what I'm going to really focus on. But before that, the other institutions I just want to mention, hospitals. You know, the hospital actually really, if you study the history of the hospital really emerged in Europe after the monasteries were more or less squashed by Protestantism in Northern Europe. And actually, monasteries used to kind of serve the function, but not that well in some cases, but then the many hospitals today still don't do that well. But anyway, hospitals are an important place. And where can the Enlightenment sort of orientation be of help in hospitals? I call your attention to the work of John Kabat-Zinn, for example, who I'm sure many of you have heard of or are familiar with his work. He's now in the process of raising, with the blessing of the state of Massachusetts, $10 million to create a stress reduction facility, a model of its kind for the nation, attached to the University of Massachusetts Medical School. And this is like, it looks like a zendo, or it looks like a monastery, but there's not a single religious symbol in it. There's a few biofeedback machines and a few little people running around, and then their one thing might be this pillow that sits on the floor in the meditation space. But it's a total meditational service, calming the mind, giving some basic instruction, some basic in support that everything is all going to be all right to all these people with these, like, frantically beating heart rates, you know. And I'm sure he will succeed, and he works in ghettos, and he works in prisons, and he works all around. He brings this service there in this non-religious way, and a medical type of way, and I think that's very, very valuable. Then there are hospices. So Stress Reduction Center is like a major place where Buddhism, without being Buddhism, can do an enlightening and helpful job for many, many people through the mode of the medical mode. Then there are many hospices where people can die well and nicely. People, there are AIDS hospices, there are just general dying hospices, and there are ways of helping them do that by getting them to concentrate and calm their mind, even using their Christian symbols, Jewish symbols, secular symbols, whatever it is, not necessarily Buddhist ones. And there's a great deal of lore from the Book of the Dead type of tradition in Tibet, and other traditions that are very helpful to them. Then mind problems, of course, is where Buddhism totally excels, and so in therapies, counselors, the transpersonal movement, and not only long-term therapy of individuals, but also counseling situations, violence, a diminishing of violence in families. We need like cadres, we need like a Peace Corps of many well-trained, enlightened, meditative social workers who can go out and can go in to help families not beat each other up and break each other's bones, and even whatever their situation, by learning to be calm, learning to control their own emotions and so forth. Then in the primary and secondary school, so there's a tremendous, that is one of the, probably the biggest place where Buddhism in the short run can help the culture. Then primary and secondary schools, we have, we're going to clone Dan Goleman and send him in with his emotional intelligence stop and go signs in all the primary schools in the whole country. He doesn't know that, but his book is going everywhere, and it's really very useful and wonderful, this emotional intelligence idea that he has developed creatively. And there'll be terrific intervention in the curriculum through that, I think. And that's the sort of way in which Buddhist thought and Buddhist interpersonal practice gets into places which are not working well. Then social work institutions, activism of various kinds, addiction clinics, martial arts associated with, grasshopper type stuff, but done in not just a way of breaking more people's bones, but in learning to control the violent impulse harnessing the violent impulse to learn to control the violent impulse in that very skillful way that it's done for self-confidence training. Environmental institutions, developing a kind of activism there, initially an activism of awareness, and then empowering people to pay attention to organic gardening and farming and overcoming food chain pollution, control and create new industries. Business, enlightened business people who use business creativity to find something profitable in things that are helpful rather than try to get short-term profit from destructive type of activities. And so we have to have enlightenment-oriented business schools. We have to have a lot of executives who can actually sit and be quiet for hours on end without doing anything, without shaking their feet and nervously jumping, and also without having like super mega heart attacks when they finally get older and become more experienced and are able to do more good by living more slowly, having only one or two divorces instead of seven, not having like to pay so many alimonies so as to make greedy short-term decisions. We need this kind of enlightened business people. And media education, of course, the media, like more enlightening programming. Imagine having like Buddha on the internet, the Dalai Lama available, Thich Nhat Hanh available, like just sort of the flick of a button, giving you a little thing about, now you just smile at this telephone. Kiss your mouse. Kiss that mouse. Stop getting irritated. Take a break from the computer. Can't you imagine? This should happen. And films and influencing the artistic and music and everything. So the media is a huge forum for this. And then politics. And I'm working on, and I will hopefully soon finish, a skeleton form of an Enlightenment Party platform for the year 2000. So Buddhists can become really engaged.
Billy Collins, born 1941, poet laureate of the United States from 2001 to 2003, who taught at Lehman College of the City University of New York for 50 years until 2016. Shoveling Snow with Buddha. In the usual iconography of the temple or the local walk, you would never see him doing such a thing, tossing the dry snow over the mountain of his bare, round shoulder, his hair tied in a knot, a model of concentration. Sitting is more his speed, if that is the word for what he does or does not do. Even the season is wrong for him. In all his manifestations, is it not warm and slightly humid? Is this not implied by his serene expression, that smile so wide It wraps itself around the waist of the universe. But here we are, working our way down the driveway, one shovelful at a time. We toss the light powder into the clear air. We feel the cold mist on our faces. And with every heave, we disappear and become lost to each other in these sudden clouds of our own making, these fountain bursts of snow. This is so much better than a sermon in church, I say out loud, but Buddha keeps on shoveling. This is the true religion, the religion of snow.
I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.